So we're going to move on now and talk about pancreatic cancer. So Lucio is going to stay on as my co-moderator. And we're happy to have Dr. Paul Overstein from the Perlmutter Comprehensive Cancer Center in New York, and Dr. Philip Phillip from the Henry Ford Cancer Center in Detroit. So we're going to be talking about pancreatic cancer. And why don't we just start out going through some data, Paul, on the selection of sequencing of therapy in these patients.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me. This is really a great opportunity to talk about, you know, what's quite a challenging cancer. So I'm going to talk today about selection and sequencing of therapy for patients with specifically metastatic pancreas cancer. And I got it. Here are some disclosures. So this is, you know, I want to cover in this brief time and then obviously in discussion some of the scope of the challenge of metastatic pancreas cancer, which is known, of course, to everyone in this audience, some of the treatment options, which really vary based on the stage of disease, and how we sort of take all that data, put it together, and make treatment decisions. There's some new agents, new clinical trials, including specifically the NAPOLI-3 trial and some subset analysis from that trial that I'll present and talk about and understand how we use those that data, and then, of course, some other factors at the end. So here, again, this is some very overall data. This is just updated every year by the American Cancer Society, and data just came out for projected numbers for 2025. You see the estimated new cancer deaths in the U.S. I highlighted pancreas with my purple box there. You see that it's number 4 and number 3 cause of cancer death, respectively, in men and women. Putting it together, it's actually the 3rd leading cause of cancer death overall in the U.S. So clearly a very large problem. And this slide, again, this all comes from the American Cancer Society updated statistics, is really sobering. I mean, there's a lot on this slide about the trends in 5-year survival for all stages, all comers of various cancers. And you see pancreas again, which I highlighted down there. The 5-year survival has gone up over the last 40 years from 3% to 13%, which is clearly an improvement, but, you know, relative to where we want to be, remember 100%, it really leaves a lot to be desired. And this is for all patients, all comers. Some of the sobering data here is that this includes neuroendocrine tumors, it includes early stage patients. So this is really, you know, not a where we need to be. And you could see it's also worse than everything else on this list. So a lot of need for progress here. I want to show again, this is data, and I'll show both slides from the same data set, that when we look at pancreas cancer today in 2025, around half of it is diagnosed at the distant stage, and this is data for different groups of patients. They're all very similar. 48% are distant. Around 16% are classified as localized, and 27% is regional. And that is a huge correlation in the 5-year survival. So those who are localized have a 44% 5-year survival, which is very good for pancreas cancer and has increased dramatically over the last 20 years. But those who have distant disease at diagnosis have an only 3% 5-year survival, meaning essentially almost none are cured. And so, you know, even though we've increased the number of patients who are diagnosed early, and we're trying very hard to do that, this is the trend among women. A very similar trend is true for men. Of the overall death rate, essentially, per 100,000 patients or people of pancreatic cancer over the last 80 years. And you could see, unlike many, many other cancers that have changed direction, the number has gone up. It's plateaued, but not gone down for overall pancreatic cancer. So this is really why we got to do stuff. So what do we do? So this is a very schematized slide. There's a lot more data that some we're going to hear in the next talk and some we've heard already about milestones in treatment of pancreatic cancer. This is over the last 30 or 40 years, and this essentially encompasses all the positive phase 3 trials. I highlighted 3 in, I don't know if they're highlighted, but, you know, 2011, the regimen of FOLFIRINOX was shown to be efficacious. In 2013, the regimen of gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. And then 10 years later, in 2023, the what's called the NAPOLI regimen of liposomal irinotecan, oxaliplatin, and 5-FU was shown to be beneficial. In addition, there's some other things. We're going to hear a lot about germline BRCA patients and the use of PARP inhibitors, and then very small population that benefits from immunotherapy. So, you know, let me go over some of this data, again, very well known to everyone here, but certainly important to understand how we make treatment decisions. So the PRODIGE study, one of the PRODIGE studies published in 2011, compared FOLFIRINOX to gemcitabine for metastatic pancreas cancer, did show a significant survival benefit, as you see on the left, but at the cost of substantial toxicity. And again, this is from the publication, highlighting some of the grade 3 or 4. So these are very, you know, significant toxicities, including hematologic. So neutropenia was seen in 45%, grade 3 or 4 neutropenia, compared to around 20% in the gemcitabine group. You could see many toxicities that we know and see in our patients that are apparent with this regimen. The second regimen that led to FDA approval was gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, which was compared to gemcitabine alone. Again, there was a survival benefit, as you see here on the left curve. And again, it came at the cost of significant toxicity. It's very hard to read, I guess, unless you have a very big screen, that there was increased hematologic toxicity as well as other toxicity when you combine the therapy. And so this led us with two, you know, robust regimens. What we didn't have was any direct comparison. So there have been a very, very limited amount of data set to compare a FOLFIRINOX or 5-FU-based regimen to a gemcitabine-based regimen. One of the trials, which was a small trial run by the SWOG cooperative group, looked at patients who were resectable, so not metastatic, and randomized them to get one or two of the regimens. And I like to show this because, first of all, not many people have done these trials. And it was small, it was around 100 patients, 50 in each arm, but you could see the curves here, and they essentially look identical. So we really didn't have data, now that's in the resectable setting, we didn't have a lot of data in the metastatic setting. And so until we had data, we have to consider, you know, some of the important factors. What stage of disease, what's the evidence in that specific stage, and there's differences in adjuvant and neoadjuvant. What about sequencing, right? We want to make sure patients can receive multiple lines of therapy if appropriate. And so how do we use that in order to make a decision? And then, of course, the side effects, which are somewhat different between the two regimens, and how do we choose for each particular patient how to go forward? I would say that, and I'll get into that in a little bit at the end, the NAPOLI-3 trial, which was presented almost 2 years ago, or exactly 2 years ago at GI ASCO and published more recently, was actually a study, a 770-patient study of metastatic patients who had randomized to direct comparison. So as you see in the, I don't know what the color is down there, the orange down, half of the patients got gem-nab-paclitaxel, just like in the prior studies. And the other half received a new regimen called NALIRIFOX, which is a modification of the FOLFIRINOX regimen utilizing liposomal irinotecan, which has liposomal bound molecules of SN38 of irinotecan and may penetrate better and have a different toxicity profile. They also modified the oxali plan and reduced the dosing. And patients were treated until progression. You can see here on the left and on the left is the progression-free survival curve, the right is the overall survival curve. There was a small but significant benefit in the combination of NALIRIFOX over gem-nab-paclitaxel. And these are subgroup analysis from the original article, just showing that really across the board, with varying degrees, those above the age of 65, which included half the patients in this trial, those with high CA19-9, head of pancreas, all of the different variables that are important to us showed benefit, or at least trend to benefit, in the NALIRIFOX arm. This is updated data that was actually presented much more recently on the left, actually at GI ASCO this year, that with 29-month follow-up, the overall survivals, the median remains the same, 11 versus 9.2 months, and is significant. But the 12-month overall survival now is showing 45% 12-month survival in the NALIRIFOX arm compared to 26% in the gem-nab-paclitaxel. And quite intriguingly, and again, this is early data, the 18-month survival with metastatic patients is 39.6%. So close to 40% 18-month survival compared to 20% in the gem-nab-paclitaxel arm. Very importantly are the side effects. So what's the sort of patient cost of side effects from this regimen? And there's a lot of nuance here on the slide, but I would point out that you could see these are the grade 3 or higher toxicities that were reported on the right of each column, essentially. And you could see that there are differences between the groups. So specifically, the NALIRIFOX group had a lower rate of site of hematologic toxicities. So for example, grade 3 or 4 neutropenia was in 23% versus 38% with gem-nab-paclitaxel. And same is true about the other ones on the slide. And on the converse, the non-hematologic toxicities were more common in the NALIRIFOX over gem-nab-paclitaxel, specifically the ones here that are listed. Right below that, the third from the bottom, is peripheral neuropathy, which somewhat surprisingly was actually similar, if not slightly lower, in the NALIRIFOX group, even though they used oxaliplatin, but there was, of course, a modified dosing, and that seemed to avoid the increased toxicity that we often see with that. This is some more data that was also just presented now at GI ASCO, a very interesting subset data of the NALIRIFOX study of this NAPOLI 3 study, where they looked at patients who had dose modifications and found that really across all groups, if a patient had a dose modification, they had a better outcome in this study than if they had no dose modifications, again suggesting that if one is aggressive about modifying the doses to make sure that we can give a drug and a combination that a patient can tolerate, we can get better and more pronounced benefit from these patients, for these patients from that regimen. One more presentation that was shown at GI ASCO this year as well was looking at one of the common questions, which is what about UGT polymorphisms, which are common in around 10% of patients, so they're not common, but they're seen in 10% and are associated with increased toxicity from irinotecan in many settings. In this randomized trial, 10% of people in each group, they were not tested beforehand, but they were tested afterwards. So around 10% of patients in each group had UGT1A1 by homozygous mutation, predicting increased toxicity. But intriguingly, they didn't have overall increased toxicity in the trial. And again, this sort of argues to the point that when we modify the treatment based on side effects, we can overcome a lot of the severe toxicity that was seen previously and can keep patients on treatment. Finally, from this data set, this is a systemic review, again, using published data, but not head-to-head comparison, so that's an important caveat. Looking at these three regimens, so NALIRIFOX on the left, FOLFIRINOX as reported in the PRODIGE study and other studies, and gem-nab-paclitaxel, and looking at select side effects, you could see for anemia, the rates of toxicity were lower than what you saw with FOLFIRINOX when you used NALIRIFOX and gem-nab-paclitaxel. The rates of neutropenia, febrile neutropenia, and platelet reductions were all lower with the NALIRIFOX regimen. And as we pointed out earlier, the rates of diarrhea were in fact higher with NALIRIFOX. Very intriguingly, in this comparison, the peripheral neuropathy was lowest in the NALIRIFOX group, and these are severe toxicity, 3 or 4, compared to gem-nab-paclitaxel and FOLFIRINOX. So quite a different toxicity profile to use when we're making treatment decisions. So what do we do, right? So I think we need to utilize this data and look at the patients sitting in front of us. We know that there's superior efficacy with NALIRIFOX over gem-nab-paclitaxel. We don't have any head-to-head comparison with FOLFIRINOX. We know that the toxicity profile is different and that you certainly need to look at these differences because they're not the same, right? So utilize the information you have for your patient. And we also want to keep in mind, what are you going to do after first-line therapy? And this comes to other data that was shown from the from this NAPOLI 3 trial, again, 770-patient trial. So there's a wealth of data we can learn from it. And you could see that in this clinical trial setting, 50% or 55% of patients overall got second-line therapy. So although we have second-line therapy, we have an FDA-approved second-line therapy, almost half of patients can't get it. And so it's super important to keep that in mind, manage the toxicity, think about how we can modify things so that we can enable patients to go on to get second-line therapy. Now, when we get to second-line, we think generally in my last minute of a few pathways. So one is identifiable targets. And we're about to hear about some of these targets. Thankfully, this list is growing, I would say, every couple months or so. These are all targets for metastatic pancreas cancer, which is a new list, right? 5 years ago, we would have had maybe one of these. But if a patient doesn't have a target, then it depends on what they got first line. So if a patient had prior 5-FU-based therapy, we give them gem-based therapy a second line. Again, the data for that is not as robust, but that's the common practice. But if a patient had prior gem-based therapy, we give them often this regimen, which is the FDA-approved regimen from what's called the NAPOLI 1 trial of liposomal irinotecan and 5-FU versus, in this study, 5-FU alone and leucovorin, showing a survival benefit, and this is FDA-approved. So this is a standard second-line regimen. And again, we want to get our patients to the point where they can get all these regimens. So finally, in summary, I would say treatment has advanced, though I showed you data showing that the five-year survival has not dramatically advanced, and we got a long ways to go to get patients out to 5 years. But the good news is that a much larger group of patients now are surviving till 18 months, and we hope that over time that, of course, will mean longer and longer. We have two general backbones. NALIRIFOX in the NAPOLI 3 trial showed improved efficacy compared to a gem-based chemo regimen, but patient factors are incredibly important because they're different regimens, they have different toxicity, and we want to choose the best regimen with the least toxicity to improve quality of life. So that's really the goal, and this data hopefully will help support that. Second-line therapy is important and needs to be part of what we do. And of course, targeted therapies, clinical trials are ongoing. We'll hear more about them in a minute. There's a lot more going on, and we'll have a big impact on the future for our patients.
So I want to turn to Philip and ask a question I've asked quite a few times with you over the years, which is, how do you just, except I think maybe the answer has changed a little bit as time is going on, which is, how do you think through first-line therapy of metastatic pancreatic cancer? And how does that vary based on the patient's age, comorbidities, complications, et cetera?
So, again, I think Paul did a great job in giving you all the components of the decision-making. At this point in time, I would look at the patient, and the first question is whether I want to give them triplet or doublet. That decision is also shared with the patient and the caregiver. So there's something there, which I have to also say that when we think of FOLFIRINOX or NALIRIFOX or gem-nab-paclitaxel, gem-nab-paclitaxel still has toxicity if you give it 3 weeks on, 1 week off. So that really opens up the room for even using it at a different regimen, for example, in older patients, giving it every 2 weeks, or even in patients who are poor performance status. So if you go back to what we have evidence now, and the only study that looked at triplet versus a doublet is really the NAPOLI 3. That's the only trial we have. At SWOG, we did the 1505, which was in the resectable setting. And in fact, there's another study, PASS 1, the 01, which also doesn't show that FOLFIRINOX is better than gem-nab-paclitaxel. So collectively, the only solid data we have is the one from NAPOLI 3. So the real thing comes down to, as clinicians, how do we really manage the toxicity and the diarrhea and how we do dose reductions. And in fact, if you remember, even from the days of the MPAC trial, patients who had dose reductions in the gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel lived longer than the ones who didn't, because the whole idea is to give the patient the quality of life, also to stay on the treatment, because the longer they are on the treatment, they're probably going to do better.
Before I ask Paul the same question, getting back to you, NALIRIFOX or FOLFIRINOX?
You're asking me? So increasingly I've known how to use the NALIRIFOX, and I will use it because of the evidence of, because of the evidence of the triplet versus doublet. The only trial that was done was the NAPOLI 3. When the gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel was first presented, we wanted to do a study versus FOLFIRINOX, but no one agreed to do that. But this was the first trial that was done in a more systematic fashion, prospective fashion.
I'm curious what you see in terms of quality of life, patient convenience, et cetera. Again, FOLFIRINOX versus NALIRIFOX.
So basically, I just want to go straight to the diarrhea. Diarrhea is obviously an issue. We're not going to, but not every single patient gets a grade 3-4 diarrhea. So trying to figure out, for example, I still do the UGT1A1. That's something I routinely do. I also, by the way, do DYPD genetic testing routinely. And my threshold for reducing the dose in subsequent treatment is very, very low. My threshold for giving the patient a supply of anti-diarrheal to use as needed. If you remember many years ago when irinotecan was first used, there was a lot of problems with the diarrhea. But now we don't talk as much about it because now we learn to be more aggressive about it, how to deal with it. But the issue is, are people afraid of dose reduction sometimes? Yes, they are. They think this is the standard of care. I don't get too frightened of reducing the dose of it in a patient when you have the other things that compensate for that toxicity. The neuropathy is less, as you mentioned, the myelosuppression is also different with the nalirifox. So if we learn how to use the combination better, we have a combination that has been proven to be superior to a doublet in a phase 3 trial. That's as far as we can go.
So Paul, same question, kind of going beyond the data as Philip just did in terms of getting into the granularity of clinically what you see tolerability-wise, how you think it through, how you share it with the patient.
Yeah, and I mean, this question's been ongoing for quite some time, as you referenced. I think, you know, seeing this kind of data really helps us in some way. I think the 2-year survival, the 18-month survival, the 12-month survival, I think that really matters and speaks to patients more so than maybe median. Meaning if we can say to them, this regimen gives you a greater chance of being alive a year from now, 2 years from now, but it's at a cost of toxicity, right? And then they make that decision of sort of when you describe the toxicity, is it something I want to give a try for? And I'd say we certainly have increased the amount of 5-FU or nalirifox-based treatment at the expense of gem/nab-paclitaxel in patients, where previously we, you know, if someone was frail or elderly or certainly you would worry about comorbidities, I think this gives us a lot more comfort with the caveat of the GI toxicity. So diarrhea is real and it's no fun, right? And I think there's other toxicity, of course, but that's one that we really take into account. I think, let me just finish. The one of the challenges we have is looking at FOLFIRINOX and asking ourselves, can we modify FOLFIRINOX the way they modified it in this trial, in the NAPOLI-3 trial, and get the same outcome? We don't know the answer. No one knows the answer. It's just a little challenging to take a patient, say, you know, FOLFIRINOX is the FDA, or not the FDA, but the approved regimen, and we're just going to reduce the oxaliplatin by 30% and expect from cross-trial comparison that's going to do okay. It makes me nervous. I don't know what would happen, but until we have that kind of trial, I'm not so comfortable doing that.
Phil?
I mean, my simple point, Neil, is you also need to keep an eye on the patient when you start the treatment. I mean, writing a script and then patient starts treatment and then you say, I'll see you back in 2 weeks or 4 weeks, it doesn't work that way. You have to really see them within the week after starting the treatment. To me, that's a critical visit for me because that's how I set the tempo. It's like buying a computer and if it fails in 2 weeks, you know that there's something wrong with it rather than something waits too long. So, and you get it replaced. So that's the whole thing. It's the early check on the patient or even call them or something. And sometimes that doesn't happen. And I see patients sometimes coming and they went through so bad of a toxicity. Because the thing is, after a week, even if they're having a lot of diarrhea, you can still take care of it, for example, by fluids, by antidiarrheal, etc., and make it easier. But if the patient doesn't get that care, the patient will be saying, I don't want it anymore.
So, Lucia, curious about your thoughts, your experiences,
sure.
Any questions you might have. You know, as you know, you all have met with a bunch of the fellows that have attended here.
Yep.
You know, they're walking into oncology trying to figure out. This is a common, very, very difficult situation. Any comments?
Yeah, certainly. I think nalirifox has been the to-go regimen for us in practice, barring any insurance issues, which it has been minimized lately. I was just curious about UGT and maybe get the audience here, show of hands. Who always checks UGT pre-therapy with irinotecan? Can you raise your hands? So we're talking about 10, 20, let's say 20% or so ballpark. So I have checked and I stopped checking, I'm checking now. So when you get a UGT polymorphism, what do you do? Do you go to gem/paclitaxel or do you lower the dose of the irinotecan part? How do you manage in practice?
Philip?
For UGT-101?
Yeah.
So UGT-101, you really have to diagnose or exclude the UGT-101 homozygous, mm-hmm. which is the Gilbert syndrome, basically.
Right.
And if I see that, in my practice, I go straight to 50% of the dose of whether it's irinotecan or liposomal irinotecan. So that's really my first initial thing. Granted, when FDA approved the UGT-101, it didn't give directions of what you do, for example, in the heterozygous. But still, if I see a heterozygous patient, I will reduce it by maybe 30-40%, just to be on the safe side. You can always go up.
Yeah.
But for homozygous, no, you have to, in my opinion, you have to really go half. Now, some patients, they might just breeze through it and you can go up. But I think I don't want to take the risk in a 50% homozygous patient.
Yeah, that makes sense. My rule of thumb is 25% and 50% respectively. But other question, how do you manage olaparib for a patient with a BRCA or a BRCAness like HRD, ATM mutation, insofar as tolerability with chemotherapy sequencing? How do you do that?
Paul?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think, you know, well done.
Thank you. And I think Philip's going to go through some of the data. But
I want to thank you. I think it gets a little tricky because what's quite interesting with NALIRIFOX is that there are a subset of patients who don't seem to have severe toxicity as sort of build. And they're doing it and they're sailing along because they don't get the neuropathy as severely. They don't really need to stop the oxali after 4 or 6 months, which is, of course, what you would do with olaparib treatment. So I think it hasn't come up that often yet. It's a pretty new regimen.
Right.
But I think you have to stop chemo to justify using olaparib. And really, we use it in patients who need to stop oxaliplatin because of neuropathy and those who are just sick of chemotherapy and want to take a chance.
Yep, that makes sense. Quick question. High TMB in pancreatic cancer. I'm yet to see a patient that responds only high TMB. I had one patient with MSI high that did respond with pembrolizumab. But TMB high, it seems like a different animal. Any comments on this?
From my experience, and I'm going to say this before I start my talk, every single patient I see newly diagnosed with advanced metastatic disease or even locally advanced, I do the tissue NGS, I do the blood ctDNA NGS, and I do germline. So with that background, I have done, 100, 200, 300 patients since I started doing this. I haven't seen high TMB, except in one or two patients who had MSI high, and also one patient who had poly mutation. So it's really, in pancreatic cancer, it doesn't come really that easy for you to find a TMB. And the cutoff point, what's the cutoff point for TMB in pancreatic? I don't know. Is it 10, 11, 11.5? I don't know that.
Yeah.
Have you seen responses to IO?
I've seen response in the MSI high patient. But TMB, I don't recall any patient that can say, yes, we won.
I think it was the GYN session. Somebody brought up something I had never heard about poly, that there's some poly that's not hypermutated. You do a TMB and it's actually not high.
I mean, the poly, I've seen maybe a couple of patients in all this length of time. They both had like millions of mutations with TMB of over 150, and they responded well. So, but again, I don't know. Maybe there is another one, yeah.
Paul, update on neoadjuvant therapy.
Yes, so I alluded to it very briefly. Our traditional history has been using the same thing that we use for metastatic in the neoadjuvant setting. SWOG and other studies suggested that might not be the smartest approach. And we really need clinical trials. So I think there is a very large ongoing trial in resectable patients looking at neoadjuvant versus adjuvant chemo. Everyone's waiting for those results. I can have predictions, but even once we get those results, the regimen they use is FOLFIRINOX, so we won't know what to do about other regimens, so that remains a very open area.
Will you do neoadjuvant therapy in a patient who has resectable disease outside of trial?
So I would say in our center, it's a little bit of a struggle. It depends on what you call resectable. Very often when we start doing really high-powered CT scans and CA19-9, we find things that make us concerned. But if they're truly resectable, I offer it to the patients because it's easier, but I don't recommend it universally.
Philip?
The story of resectable disease is very interesting, Neil. A number of years ago, it was difficult to convince surgeons in the tumor board, at least in the places I've worked, to go for chemotherapy. Now, the trend in the United States has shifted very much towards neoadjuvant treatment, to the point that the study that Paul is referring to, which is the Alliance trial, had some difficulty in accruing because surgeons now, for some reason, they bought into the idea of neoadjuvant treatment. So to answer your question, many more patients now are getting treatment with neoadjuvant therapy, including in my center. And there are some pilot studies being done, for example, in the East Coast on the use of NALIRIFOX as I think Sloan Kettering will be the place where they're doing that, even as a pilot trial to see how it does in that situation.
So final question before Philip gets into his talk, Paul. Again, sort of adjuvant therapy update. And I'm curious what you do in the adjuvant and maybe neoadjuvant setting if you know the patient's a BRCA positive.
Yeah, so I mean, as Philip said, I would say a large proportion of our patients are getting neoadjuvant therapy. And so we generally complete 6 months of therapy with whatever is remaining One of the tricky spots is if they didn't have a good response, you know, do you switch? And it's a data-free zone. But in the adjuvant setting, I mean, the best data if someone's naive to chemo is from FOLFIRINOX, and that's what we generally favor. Certainly patients who have a BRCA mutation, we favor using a platinum-based therapy. So favor FOLFIRINOX or NALIRIFOX anyways. Again, most of those would get that regimen anyways.
What about PARP?
So we're part of, there are cooperative group trials that we're enrolling patients on, giving PARP inhibitor as a maintenance therapy. So it's a randomized trial of olaparib versus placebo. We've put a good number of patients on that trial, and so we hope someone else will too, so that we can get results.
Yeah. Would you treat off study with a patient?
I would struggle to treat off trial. There are toxicities, and it's
Philip,
it's pancreatic cancer, right? How many opportunities do you have? I mean, I hate to say this because the Apollo trial that Paul is referring to, we need more patients on it because they want to complete the trial. But to be honest with you, if God forbid I'm the patient or my family member, do I need to wait for that trial to mature in 3, 4, 5 years from now? It's pancreatic cancer. It's not colorectal cancer giving them FOLFOX.
That's true.
Great thought there, Philip. All right, let's take a look at some data.
So again, as I mentioned, I do molecular profile every patient I see. In fact, I have to also admit that I do that in the localized disease because of some of the questions I was asked by Dr. Love. Do you use, which drug do you use? Because that is now going into the localized disease also. And also, I'm sure you read a few days ago the article in the Wall Street Journal, which was really saying pancreatic cancer is having new drugs. So I'm going to touch on some of these drugs. That is my... One of the things about pancreatic cancer is that, like many cancers, there's a lot of patients who will have what we call DNA repair defects, DDR. And people estimate that it's up to 25%. But the DDR system is a complex system. However, we're focusing on the BRCA1 and 2 germline mutations, and with it comes the PALB2 mutation. And you can even slip into the POLE, which is even rarer. 5 to 7% of the patients we see in the United States can have germline mutations, and also it depends on where you're living, whether in the East Coast or the middle of the country, because some places have more based on, for example, Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. 40% of the patients have germline BRCA1/2 mutation and carry that, but there's no history of cancer in the family. Keep that in mind. I have a lady who is a white lady from northern Michigan, and she has BRCA2 mutation. She doesn't have any family history, and she's someone who you may not suspect to have that. But that really tells you something, that every single patient who comes to you has to be tested for the BRCA mutation, and that's simply a recommendation now. Now again, for the sake of time, why should we use PARP inhibitors? There's a mechanism called synthetic lethality. So just to make it simple, one of the genes that encode for BRCA is defective, they don't have enough of it, and therefore the cell is trying to compensate by trying to repair, they have to repair the DNA damage, right? Some patients couldn't do it, therefore they got the pancreatic cancer, but the ones who have the pancreatic cancer, they still have that gene. And if you hit the cell with something that requires the help of another molecule, here is the PARP1, then it can probably do some repair. But if the PARP1 is also inhibited, blocked by a PARP inhibitor, then the cell cannot sustain itself and it will die. So that led to the use of olaparib in patients with advanced pancreatic cancer. This was an ambitious trial because the number of patients are not that many, but it was done internationally. It had 154 patients, and the design is very straightforward, olaparib versus placebo. And in this trial, they showed that olaparib, after patients have maintained stable or improving disease after at least 4 months of combination chemotherapy, and most patients receive FOLFIRINOX, by the way. But I have to say that in my practice, I have patients, like this patient I mentioned to you, she's up north, and she doesn't want to carry the pump and come back and forward. She's very much wanting to have treatment with me. I put her on gemcitabine and cisplatin. You can do that also, because there's evidence that any platinum, including cisplatin, or maybe even better than Oxali, we don't know. Anyway, so when they were stable 4 months or better, then they get the olaparib, and certainly the olaparib delayed their progression of the disease. So this is important because the placebo was the control arm. But then again, think of if they didn't get placebo, they would have gotten chemotherapy. And the question is, do you get the same answer? Probably not, because here you're giving a specific target therapy in patients who have been selected that they will be better to respond to the treatment given that they responded to platinum. The overall survival was a bit more difficult to really show an improvement statistically, although there was a trend. But also keep in mind, some of those patients also crossed over to receive olaparib when they were progressing. So it might be a bit more difficult to really talk about that. The side effects, the major ones, I would say, you get anemia with it. And 25% of the patients had treatment-related toxicity. And discontinuation rate because of the AEs was 8.9%. Again, it goes back to how do we manage toxicity as we learn more how to use a treatment. This is an important one. Looking at the health-related quality of life data, the studies, when they looked at it, the deterioration of the health-related symptoms or quality of life was certainly slowed down by the use of olaparib. Again, think of if we didn't give olaparib, if you give FOLFIRI or if you give even single agent chemotherapy like fluoropyrimidine, you're probably going not to be the same thing. So this is a question for you. You do the NGS like I've done, and I got a patient this week who had ATM mutation. And the question is, if we have ATM mutation, do we treat them with olaparib? And the short answer is the data is really very difficult to really give you a definitive answer. And again, talking between us and including people who do more with this work, at this point in time, we don't have definite evidence. When it comes to DDR and the mutations, the definite one is BRCA and POLB mutation, germline mutations. And the rest, we still don't know. So just to say the same thing, like any patient newly diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, we do germline testing, looking for BRCA, but it's not only the BRCA, but BRCA becomes an important one, both from the aspect of treatment, but also from the aspect of genetic counseling.
Moving on. Before you get off that, just curious, what other alterations will you consider, for example, PALB2, also somatic versus germline?
At this point in time, based on one or two studies, cases that have, like, they were treated with another PARP inhibitor, there is evidence that if you have somatic mutation, you can also respond, BRCA1 or 2, yeah. So if I see a patient with BRCA1 or 2 somatic mutation, then I would still treat them with olaparib.
And what about other mutations?
So other mutations looking for, I mentioned the ATM, that can be germline.
Will you treat?
The ATM mutations I mentioned, we don't have good evidence to treat. We don't have it yet. You can also look for other gene mutations like the P16 gene, CDKN2A. You can look at CHEK2. So there are a number of gene mutations that can be germline, which is important to know from the counseling, genetic counseling perspective. But from the treatment part, we're still waiting for some data.
Yeah, I remember a case of a patient with metastatic disease we had presented who ended up being BRCA germline in his daughter was found to be BRCA germline. She had, you know, prophylactic mastectomy. It was kind of an incredible legacy.
Yes. So an NRG1 fusion. So gene fusions have also become important in this disease. However, when you look at the frequency, it's less than 1%, but still is an important one because if you get one, then it's targetable, and if it's targetable, then and you can see that the responses will also be very interesting. One thing you have to keep in mind, it's enriched. This is all comers, but it's enriched in patients who are KRAS wild type, and I'll come to that. And also it's enriched in patients who are younger than 60, and in fact we're seeing more of those patients. This was a study we did in collaboration with one of the vendors, and we looked at over 2,000 patients. And if you look at the right side of the slide, wild-type patients, and they were 10% of the population, by the way, you see an enrichment of fusions, targetable fusions. So it just gives you an idea of the value of doing NGS. But what I'm saying now is really going to be irrelevant in a few months or a year, because you have to do NGS because KRAS targeting, which I'm coming to it. So KRAS targeting, but also those who are wild type, their potential for other treatments, including targeting NRG1 fusion. So just briefly, the NRG1 combines with the HER3 and it dimerizes with HER2, leads to signaling downstream. And then the antibody, which is zinocutuzumab, it's an antibody that targets the HER2 and HER3, and therefore it stops this, the downstream signaling. So this was a study that was presented actually 4 weeks ago, published 4 weeks ago in the New England Journal, which was a study in the included over 200 patients, not only pancreatic, but it also had pancreatic in it. So I'm just going to show you the efficacy of the drug in the 32 patients and of pancreatic cancer who were previously treated with chemotherapy. And you can see that the response rate was around 30%. In general, like all the population, but in pancreatic cancer patients, responses were over 40%. And you had a very decent duration of response controlled disease, which was over 6 months. So certainly there is activity there. Side effects, this is just to show you side effects, mainly grade 1 and 2 side effects. Rarely you see any significant grade 3 side effects. So a very interesting treatment, 18% diarrhea, some fatigue, some nausea, but otherwise no major side effects. So that's NRG1 fusion. The other treatment, which is really very interesting, and you'll hear about it more in ASCO coming up in June, is this TT fields, the electricity or electric fields that work on, and you heard about it in the lung session, so I'm not going to spend too much time. I'm just going to focus on a couple of things. One is, if you look at the right side of the slide, and it was mentioned actually during the discussion phase an hour or two ago, there is something to do about cell dying and immune response and all that. Why is that important for me to mention? I'll come to it in a few minutes. So this treatment is, as you would expect, someone wears the pad. It's there for 18 hours. The machine has made a bit lighter, simpler to use. And they did a phase 2 study in 6 European countries just to look at the tolerability and some early data. There were 40 patients. And and the main side effect here is skin toxicity. Well, we would expect that somehow. So that's the main side effect which we have here. This is the PANOVA 3 phase 3 trial, which had over 500 patients. And it was a combination with TT field plus gemcitabine paclitaxel versus the control arm, gemcitabine paclitaxel. Primary endpoint was overall survival, which to me is interesting because when we do trials, there's a lot of tendency to really use a progression-free survival as a primary endpoint. But they went for overall survival, which I think was a bit ambitious. But then again, this was on December 2nd. It was announced that it was a positive trial, with at least two-month median survival advantage. And if you look at the improvement at 12 months, 13%, and improvement at 24 months is 33%. So why am I linking this to the immunology thing? Because it's possible that this treatment is really changing the microenvironment within the tumor in a way that's allowing the biology to change and let the patients survive longer. It also means that it may be an opportunity for us to really combine this with other treatments, for example, immunotherapy. Okay, now moving on to continuing with the genomics. So 90% we mentioned that KRAS positive, they have mutation. And as you know, over the years, it was really very difficult to think of something that we can do in those patients. And a KRAS mutation is very early during the development of the cancer. And there are different mutations. The most frequent one is D, and then comes the V, and then R, DVR. And also you're aware of the G12C, which I'm not going to really talk about today. So that's where the start was in patients with pancreatic cancer, the G12C mutation targeting, which is 1% to 2% of the patients. But the real thing is, how do we go after the more common ones, the DVR? And there are various ways that you can target the now the pathway, either directly to KRAS or around it, like downstream. But the one which I really want to show you is that there are a number of clinical trials currently ongoing, and these trials, this is just a, it's not an updated list, but there are many more trials, but you can see that there are different targets, G12D, or it could be a pan-RAS target, and the one which really we had some very interesting results is the one which was a pan-KRAS inhibitor, RMC-6236, and you can see that the in terms of the survival and the progression-free survival, it's really very interesting, intriguing. And also the depth of the responses that have been seen. And this has now gone into a phase three trial, prospective phase three trial called RASolute 302, which is a second-line trial and in patients with metastatic disease, which is using this compound versus standard of care second-line treatment. So certainly something which is really worth thinking about. Side effects, one of the major side effects will be the skin rash, but also maybe stomatitis and diarrhea. The other thing, which goes back to what we were talking about, early stage disease, is the use of the vaccines now in that context. And this is a study that was published 2 years ago, and there was an update a few weeks ago on it, and there's a lot of, obviously, news items going around it. This is personalized RNA neoantigen vaccines, to stimulate the T-cell attack in the pancreatic cancer cell. This was a study in resected patients, so it's not metastatic disease. And this is an area which obviously is expanding very fast. If you look at the list, this I accessed the clinicaltrials.gov in mid-February, and this is a list of ones I found in terms of the vaccine trials in pancreatic cancer. And you can see that more than half are in patients after resection of the disease. And there are different varieties of platforms that are being used, including mRNA, but also there is there are studies going after the KRAS as a vaccine. So something which will take an hour to talk about, but I just wanted you to be aware of it. Going back to the issue of the synthetic lethality we talked about, there's another opportunity in pancreatic cancer, in fact, a sizable one in 20%, where patients can have MTAP loss. And patients with MTAP loss, now there are a number of studies that are trying to, again, the same principle of the synthetic lethality, a number of drugs at this point in time, like the AMG 193 study that we have in our institution. So something to keep in mind. The reason why I'm mentioning all those studies is to reinforce the fact that you have to do the NGS, and second, you have now options to refer patients for a number of these options, whether there are KRAS inhibitors, vaccines. So, just to conclude, all newly diagnosed patients, in my opinion, should get the germline testing and also tumor profiling. Olaparib is currently the standard of care in patients as a maintenance treatment after favorable response to platinum-based treatment. And Tulsurbab is effective in patients who have NRG fusions. But again, to reach to that point, you have to really do the NGS. And the enrichment is within the KRAS wild type and also younger patients. The TT fields prolong survival in patients with locally advanced pancreatic cancer, so that will be another, hopefully another treatment option for those patients. And they're promising other targets, like we talked about KRAS. I didn't mention the Claudin 18.2 because the study has been completed. We don't have the outcome yet. And also all the vaccines that are currently being developed.
So that was exciting to see all these new therapies. Interesting about the Tumor Treating Fields. One final question back to you, Paul. I was chatting with Lucio, and he brought up the issue of nutritional support in these patients, pancreatic enzyme replacement, immunonutrition, and improving outcomes and tolerability of systemic therapy. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, again, that could be a long discussion, but pancreatic enzyme support is absolutely critical. So many of these patients have abnormal metabolism from that, and we utilize it very broadly, similar to the way we use chemo, titrating it up and down, you know, frequently, but it's super important to enable patients to get treatment.
So we're going to move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.